call to order the House Revenue Committee and welcome members and guests present with us today. We just have a couple of public hearings up today. We want to find out about House Bills 2168 and 2171 brought to us from the Housing and Community Services folks. Let's start with a public hearing on House Bill 2168 and invite Jack Kenny up. Jack, can you talk about this separate from 2171? Do you want to talk about them both together? How do you want to do this? I could open the hearing on both if you wanted to, or take them separately.
Chair Shetterly, they are very much related
bills.
So I think
let me go ahead and open the public hearing then on 2171 as well, so then you can cross-reference them in your testimony freely. And, Elizabeth, why don't you give us a quick thumbnail summary of the bills then before we ask Mr. Kenny to speak.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the record, I'm Elizabeth Martin-Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. So with 2168 and 2171, it's dealing with the corporate income tax credit, which is basically for financial institutions that give low interest loans to people who want to develop low-income housing. So basically, what like with 2168, it's adding then just some quantifiers about that it's gonna you can have a qualified assignee as well as a lending institution as being eligible to claim this low-income housing corporate excise tax credit. So it does this replacing of lending institution with taxpayers in several locations of the bill. Then it also increases the total income tax credit cap for financiers of the loans for low-income housing from $6 million to $8.2 million. And it applies to tax credits that are claimed beginning on or after January 1st, 2003, and it takes effect 91 days after the end of session. So basically, with you have a revenue impact on both these bills. And
Elizabeth, the revenue impact on 2168 is on account of increasing the cap, is that it?
That's right.
The qualified S&E change doesn't have a revenue impact.
Correct.
Okay.
Chair Shetterly, that both of these bills increase the cap from $6 million to $8.2 million annually. That is the cap for the Housing and Community Development Department can issue of credit. So basically, with the only real major difference between the two revenue impacts is that with House Bill 2171, it also adds in pre-development charges to the list of eligible charges for the corporate income tax credit. And so that's the major difference between them. And then with 2171, it also then is putting a limit on the amount of the income tax credit that can be attributable to loans that are just for pre-development charges. And those pre-development costs cannot be no more than $200,000 each year, the credit portion of those loans. And again, the credit, as it's calculated, it is the difference between the finance charge on the loan that is given at the special interest rates and the finance charge that would have been charged at the market interest rates. And that difference then cannot exceed 4% of the unpaid balance of the loan during any tax year. So that's basically how then you're limiting each year the amount of the credit. And so basically with 2171, when you have these pre-development charges included in the bill, then you also define what are pre-development charges. And then also you are saying that the amount of savings from the reduced interest rate due to the pre-development cost is not required to be passed through to the tenants in the form of lower rents for the low-income housing units, where typically this program does require all interest savings to be directly credited as rent reductions, and that's a part of qualifying for the program. As far as the history on this cap, beginning in tax year 2002, the corporate tax credit was limited to $6 million per year. Prior to 2002, then this credit was limited to $5 million per year. And as far as the revenue impact on 2171, it's roughly $1.9 million in the 03-05 biennium, $3.66 million in the 05-07 biennium, and then would raise to 07-09 biennium when it would be fully implemented as far as this additional $2.2 million in the cap, so have a revenue impact by the 07-09 biennium of $4.4 million. So it's basically going to take a few bienniums before you would see the full impact of the $2.2 million each year in both of these cases. And really, with the pre-development charges limited to only $200,000 of the credit each year, it doesn't have a real big difference between the two bills.
All right. Thank you very much. Jack.
Chair Shirley, members of the committee. Again, my name is Jack Kenney. I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services, and I do appreciate the opportunity to come to you today and speak in support of both House Bill 2168 and House Bill 2171. Your committee administrator did a good job of outlining what the bills do, but I'll just kind of touch on it again briefly, and I have had an opportunity to meet with some of you. It does, I mean, the major piece and the common piece between both these bills is that it does increase the statutory cap from 6 to 8.2 million. This program has been a very effective tax credit in that all the tax credit that is allowed to the taxpayer is passed through in rent savings to low-income tenants. So it is a very efficient tax credit in the state of Oregon, and our department can demonstrate any dollar of tax credit claimed by a bank or financial institution does equate to a dollar in rent savings given to a low-income tenant. Tax credit has been around since 1989. The tax credit is typically given for 20 years, so eventually these loans start to repay and we will have new room under the cap. But at current levels, we do expect that we will exceed the $6 million cap in the next biennium, and that's why we're here before you today. There have been other increases in this credit since its inception in 89, and in the last few biennia, we've been coming with enough to last us for two biennia with the increase, and I think that's consistent with what your committee administrator described. The program is... It serves a variety of low-income populations statewide. Examples include seniors, chronically mentally ill, developmentally disabled, and other populations. In some cases, the rents are reduced for all units, but we do permit deep skewing to a portion to enable us to reach very low-income populations. This was done, for example, at Pelican's Perch in a seniors project in Brookings. Initially, the project was slated to serve primarily 60% of area median income, but with the HTC, they were able to make available 5 units at 30 and 40% of area median income, reducing rents by $110 and $230 per month. Another example is the Grotto, an 8-unit project serving developmentally disabled women in Salem. The OAHTC allowed them to reduce rents by $158 for all residents. This ability to reach 30 and 40% of area median incomes is particularly important in light of the federal policy change in the early 80s to significantly limit the amount of new Section 8 property. And that's the federal program whereby a person is able to pay just what they can afford in rent. If they earn $100 a month, for example, they pay $30 in rent, and the federal Section 8 vouchers would make up the difference. That program was significantly reduced in the early 80s, and as a result, HUD estimates that there's approximately only 29% of people in Oregon eligible for Section 8 that are actually able to receive it. So this Oregon program has been a great supplement to the existing Section 8 program to allow us to reach very low-income populations, and it's one of the few programs that's allowed us to do that. Many of our programs can serve people at 50, 60% of area median income, but we need this extra credit to get to those lower income levels. The amount is capped annually at $6 million, as was described. As I said, we need new authority to get us through the next biennium. I also want to say that the department, Oregon Housing and Community Services, carefully evaluates applications for OAHTC. We don't just give it to everybody who applies. We have targeted amounts, so we do monitor or meter the amounts of tax credits that are allowed on an annual basis. We identify how much we will award, and we award them on a competitive basis in a process we call our consolidated funding cycle, where people compete. So typically somebody's going to have to bring a pretty good project for us to be able to receive the credits. In the last 2 years, we approved 58% of the applicants for the credits. And Those approvals were instrumental in assisting 36 developments with 1,164 units of affordable housing during that period. Let me just talk a little bit about the difference between the two bills. As your committee administrator pointed out, 2171 provides a new use for the program, and that's to provide pre-development loans. Typically, that is a need that low-income or nonprofit housing developers really have the need for. They typically don't have a lot of cash sitting around in the bank in order to secure property or to pay for fees or architects, a lot of the early costs. So there's been, I guess, less and less availability of pre-development funds in Oregon recently. And this was at the banker's suggestion that we added this component. Now, this does meet a huge unmet need for the pre-development loans, but it won't have the ability to pass through rents, because when you're just securing land or buying permits, there's really no rent structure in place to pass through the rents to. But we have limited the amount of tax credits that can be used for the pre-development loan to $200,000. That would equate to about $5 million in pre-development loans. We expect the pre-development loans will typically be repaid on a shorter-term basis, so those loans will only be outstanding for a year or two in most cases, whereas the loans that reduce rent are 20-year loans, typically. Again, the difference between the two bills is House Bill 2171 does allow the use of the $200,000 of the credit for pre-development loans, and 2168 adds clarifying language as to who is a qualified assignee. Again, in discussion with bankers and others in the interim, the program was changed a while back to change the name of the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit from the Lender's Tax Credit. Language relative to qualified assignees was added to the statutes in 91. But how the credit would work for a qualified assignee wasn't really clear, and we had discussions with the AG's office as to how we might do that, and they helped us craft language. That's included in 2168 that clarifies if one of these tax credits was assigned from a bank to another institution, such as an insurance company, how would the credit be claimed? So 2168 adds that clarifying language. House Bill 2171 adds the component for pre-development use. Other than that, the bills do have in common the increase in the cap to $8.2 million from the current $6 million. The Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit is important to Oregon for several reasons. It is an effective tool to achieve rents that are afforded to citizens at very low income levels. The credit provides a direct tangible benefit to at-risk populations. When housing costs are affordable, individuals and families reduce their reliance on other social services, and in many instances are better able to achieve self-sufficiency. Furthermore, without this legislation, there will be a reduction in the development of new affordable housing. Housing construction provides strong economic benefits to Oregon communities, creating jobs and demand for a variety of products. We ensure approved housing developments meet community standards. It is not uncommon for this housing to be important to revitalizing a neighborhood, thereby improving surrounding property values. The proposed enhancement to the tax credit is an investment in Oregon communities, and I urge your support. I'd also like to address a few questions that I had while I was talking about this bill to individual members of the committee. Representative Haas, for example, asked how this would work for banks. What might they gain from this? And I've talked to some bankers since then. This does benefit them only in the extent that they're able to better meet the their Community Reinvestment Act, their CRA credits. They can do this in a variety of ways. So this particular bill isn't the only tool to do that. But what it does do, and I'll let the bankers that testify address this further, but it allows them to participate in these programs by in a way that they might not otherwise be able to do so. It allows them a tax credit, yet they're giving up earnings on this. They're giving up profits. So it really does not enhance their bottom line, so to speak, but it does allow them to participate in Oregon investments in affordable housing. Representative Verger asked me about the Revenue Coalition And I pulled their website and looked at some of the things that they've talked about in closing the loopholes. They talked about purposes that represent good public policy, and they identified affordable housing as one of their identified public purposes. So I believe that this is consistent with what that organization is looking for as well.
We already ran over them on a couple housing.
Thank you. Finally, in regard to venture capital, this is... I think affordable housing and some of the developers that may testify after me might be able to talk to this about this. I wish we had more precise information, and we're working to get that on what the impact is, multiplier impact of developing affordable housing. But as I mentioned, anecdotally, clearly having rents where people aren't having to give up food or medicine costs or education that are affordable to them clearly benefit individual families, and the development of affordable housing itself does create jobs and a needed economic impact to the community. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Other questions for Mr. Kinney? Representative Virgin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In House Bill 2171, I have several questions for you, Jack. House Bill 2171, the reduced interest rate is not required to be passed on. Is that any different than former bills that you've had, a farmer development that you've had?
Chair Shirley, Representative Berger, you're correct in that that the interest rate savings do not have to be passed on, but that's only for the $200,000 pre-development portion. For the balance, the $8 million cap, the rent savings would continue to be passed through. It is a new component of the bill. We talked about would there be ways, perhaps even with the pre-development, to pass it through in rents later on, and it just became very cumbersome. You would be creating rules and trying to tie something in for a 20-year stream on a pre-development loan that it just, the administrative costs seemed to outweigh the benefits. And so because we limited the amount where the rents don't have, where the income interest savings don't have to be passed on to just a small piece of the cap, the $200,000, we felt that it was acceptable. Plus, I think some people might testify later that reducing the cost, particularly in the case of a nonprofit or someone who has a social purpose as they're developing housing, if they get those savings, even though there's not a direct pass-through in the rent, these projects are pretty skinny anyway, and they will likely take those savings and, again, not use it to increase their bottom line as much as to cut costs so that they're able to develop these projects that are affordable.
Follow-up?
Yes, sure.
I'd like to play the devil's advocate here a little bit, because the bills are not tied to the need for more housing. In other words, in my area, I get a lot of opposition to added affordable housing because we have very high vacancy rates. And so the people in the private sector who have invested and are now left with having to pay are unable to reduce their rents a substantial amount, and yet we continue to look at more affordable housing. So I think when you're looking at government-subsidized housing and you're looking at competition with the private sector, you obviously have people that are not as pleased with bills, particularly like this, that don't address the need. You perhaps have needs in other parts of Oregon that you don't have a high vacancy rate. So I wonder if you might address that problem for me, because that certainly would come in my district.
Chair Shelley, Representative Verger, you're correct, and I've been in Coos Bay this summer, and certainly we have our regional field representatives who meet with the community. The last thing we want to do is compete with the private sector if they're providing the same housing. I'll make a couple points in response to this. One, it is a competitive process. As I mentioned earlier, we don't give the credits to everyone who applies, and one of the elements of that competitive process is community support. So if the community is not supportive of the project, it won't score as well in that competitive process. And I think, to your point, I think there's probably been very little that we've done in the Coos Bay area other than, I think, for some mentally handicapped people where the private sector was not providing that housing. So that's one safeguard on this, is that we do have that competitive process with community support as a big piece of it. Another element is the populations that are typically served by this program. As I mentioned, developmentally disabled, seniors that are on very low income, fixed income. Many times, you just can't get to making housing affordable for these populations without some kind of a subsidy. And let me just say, too, that we work very closely with the private sector, with the apartment owners and the multi-unit housing groups, with notifications when we're going to do a project to let them know ahead of time. And there was a bill passed in last session by people who have the, expressing the opinion that you're just described, that we want to know if these things are coming in, because if we have vacancy rates, we don't want you causing further damage. So we do have public notification projects when we're going to build a project in. We've looked at programs. We recently, and this is off the subject of this bill a little bit, just to let you know that our department is aware of your concerns and is trying to address them. We've instituted a pilot program called Tenant Readiness Training, where we work with private sector landlords who do have vacancies, and with people who perhaps coming off of a homelessness or some other situation where they don't have a good credit history, maybe through no fault of their own, train those people to be good tenants and then match them up with landlords. So we're aware of the situation you described, and we're very sensitive to it. And again, I don't think we've been putting a lot of housing into areas where the market doesn't require it or want it. But again, these populations are very low income. So and there is a great unmet need. As I mentioned in my testimony earlier, HUD talked about 71% of the people in the state eligible for Section 8 housing don't receive Section 8 housing. So there is a large unmet need.
Okay, I have one last follow-up. One is let's address jobs, and that is, and maybe someone coming behind you to testify will be better able to answer this, but are the jobs that you create jobs for Oregonians, or are the jobs that you create jobs for Washingtonians or some other state? And if you would rather someone else address that, that's fine, or if you can address that.
Chair Shirley, Representative Verger, I think I would leave that to someone else, although let me just say that I would get back to you and see. Again, as I mentioned earlier, we have anecdotal information, but I can do my best to get for you better information on where are these jobs, if they're Oregonians or non-Oregonians.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Anybody else? Okay. Thank you. Kenny.
Thank you.
Let's have John Blatt. Hey, do you want to bring up Ms. Sheila Greenleaf, Greenlaw, Inc.?
Yes,
and Rita Grady.
Yes.
All right.
They're both up with me.
Good morning.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Blatt. I'm the executive director of the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations. We are an association of 50 nonprofit groups and about 50 groups that support the development of affordable housing around the state. And on right now, my members own about 9,000 units of affordable housing around the state, and they house about 15,000, a little more than 15,000 people every night in that housing. I am also the co-chair of the Housing Lobby Coalition, which is a coalition of advocates for affordable housing and people who represent the banks and the realtors and other interests in housing. And the Housing Lobby Coalition also supports House Bill 2171. So as the co-chair, I'm putting that plug in also. With me, I have two of my members who have used this tax credit to develop housing. I have Rita Greedy with Polk County CDC and Sheila Greenlaw Fink with Community Partners for Affordable Housing. In the last 12 years, my members have used this tax credit over 130 times in projects to lower the rents, so it's a significant and widely used tax credit to lower rents in our housing. And so I'm going to turn it over to Sheila to talk a little bit about her projects.
Good morning.
Thank you. I'm Sheila Greenlaw Fink with Community Partners for Affordable Housing in Tigard.
We produce about 150 units of housing, and I want to talk a little bit about one particular project we finished last year with the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit and maybe respond to some of the questions about how that fits into the market in the Tigard area, and then also a project that we hope to complete next year with Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits.
Yeah, just before you go on, I want to, this is great, John. I got Tigard and Dallas represented. You know, it's just uncanny.
Purely accidental, I'm sure, Mr. Chairman.
We had Eugene represented, and we couldn't get anyone up there.
Representative Farr wasn't going to be here today anyway.
I did resist the urge to bring pictures that had Max in front of the project. So.
And she has them, though.
John insisted that might not be the best strategy. So, but the project that I wanted to talk a little bit about that wouldn't have happened and the rents wouldn't be what they are without the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit is a project called The Village at Washington Square, which we completed last spring, and we'll give you some pictures of. This project, 26 units, urban infill in the Portland metro area, in an area where the private sector clearly isn't meeting the need at all levels, 20,000 jobs, 1,500 housing units. We have a lot of traffic and transportation issues in Washington County, and to a large extent, the worst in the metro area are in the Washington Square Regional Center area, which includes Tigard, Beaverton, unincorporated Washington County. So projects like this one allow us to actually serve the folks who work in that area, many of the majority of whom are retail, service sector, light industrial, really can't afford the market rents. So even when you see a softness in the market like we see in Tigard right now, the units that we produce through this program don't see that softness. We're at 100% lease up, and the reason is we're serving folks, workforce housing, folks with rents that they can actually stay in so that we don't have the turnover, so that they can pay their rent, their utilities, food, medical care, and not struggle with choices between all those kind of essential things. Just to let you know how the OHTCs affect a project like this one, the rents at the project range from $250 to $750. They're really astounding for a new construction project, and that, of course, isn't possible without some incentives like OHTC that allow us to get those rents down where they need to be to serve the people we're trying to serve. The project benefited from both state and federal tax credits, and that's what gets the majority of the equity in it. It incentivizes the private sector to work with us and the nonprofit sector to meet this need in a really efficient way without a lot of tax dollars. This project, one of the things we're trying to do again is not duplicate the private sector, but do what the private sector isn't doing, which is build larger units for families. So over half the units are 3 and 4 bedrooms in size and do, in fact, serve large families. Those are not available in the private sectors. Max can tell you, in Tigard, we had, I think, about 53 bedroom rental, multifamily rental units. All that has been done in the last few years is done in the nonprofit sector. The private sector doesn't really allow for large units. And so if a family wants to rent and live near where they work, and Tigard is a large center for employment, they need to look at single-family housing stock, which rents at over $1,000 a month. It just isn't feasible, and that's why we have so many people trying to commute in from west, you know, from the other side of the river, from Oregon City, and from places far distant from where they work. So what OHTC's allowed us to do was get down rents that otherwise would have been set to serve people at 50 to 55% of median income, which would still be great. It'd be, you know, below what the market is able to do. But it allowed us to get some of those rents deeply skewed, as Jack said, down to people at 30% of median income. And those are the people that we really serve in all our projects, even though our rents don't reflect it. We wish all our rents were that low. So, for instance, those 3 and 4 bedroom units, some of them are set from $350 to $400. It's a huge savings and a real stabilizing impact for the families that work two jobs to try to make enough to rent one apartment. What happens in the private market for folks like that is they double and triple up. This allows them to have a stable home, a place where kids can do their homework, and just to give you an idea in the kinds of things that nonprofits do in these units as well does contribute to the job security of those folks more than just in the construction that is generated when the projects are built. Also, we have high-speed internet access, computer centers. We help with resumes. We have financial literacy for youth and adults. We do a lot of school-related programs, as Max knows, with the Tigard Tualatin schools, homework help, summer youth. Right now we have a spring break program going. And so, for instance, tomorrow our kids will be taking a bus over to OMSI and learning about how houses are built in a Raising the Roof project, and they'll be learning about the physical structure of projects. And at the same time, we hope that you will provide the continued assistance to the fiscal structure of these projects with this program. It really helps us strengthen the state by providing resource to folks of modest means so that they can be participators and contribute to the economic health. I'll turn it over to Rita.
Any questions first? Rita, you can, or one of you, I think if you could address the pre-development side of this and how that would affect.
I've got some comments.
Okay, all right, we'll want to hear from that too. Rita Grady.
Thank you.
She probably does have pictures of me. I'm one of her directors.
I didn't bring any of those. Well, Polk County, or Polk Community Development Corporation, is about 13 years old, located in Dallas. And whereas some larger CDCs may develop 110, 150 units a year, we've developed 110 units, and we serve Polk County. We have 23 properties. We have both rental properties that we've used tax credit financing on, as well as home ownership properties that we've used tax credit financing on. Out of some of our properties, just the natural attrition because of the fixed rents that's possible through the tax credit, some of our families have moved on to home ownership. We have one project in particular in Independence where more than a dozen families, because they were able to save money as they were in these housing units where the rent was affordable to them, as their income increased, they were able to save the money and eventually bought homes in the community and became good taxpaying property, taxpaying residents of that community. For us, the tax credit financing has been absolutely critical. It's always difficult to try to come up with that gap financing, that 30% that you can't finance. And it's also extremely difficult to be able to meet the need for young families that cannot afford to pay $750 to $850 rent for a three-bedroom unit. It takes a young family that is going to go out on the open market, it takes them about $36,000 a year income in order to be able to meet that rent structure. We have been able to reduce our rents anywhere from $60 to $150 a month on some of our properties that are serving disabled folks because of the tax credit financing. And we've been able to go from 60 to reach down from 60% down to 45% median income. A number of years ago, we started using tax credit financing for home ownership. We were able to take the difference between the current market interest rate and the reduced interest rate and set that money aside into a savings account for the family. And in addition to some other resources that we tapped, we were able to help these families with the down payment assistance fund. This amounted to maybe $100 to $150 a month. And the average down payment assistance we were able to generate from this was about $5,000 per family. And on the average, it took families about 3.5 years to be able to purchase their homes. And we found that we've had about 20 families who were able to move on into home ownership. I feel that raising the level of the tax credit financing is going to help practitioners like us be more creative and be able to help more people. We did a market analysis in 2002 when we were getting ready to construct 40 units in Dallas. And we learned from that market analysis that just in one city, just in the city of Dallas, we had an unmet need of 280 families who were paying way more than 30% of their income on rent. And we created 40 units, and by the time we created those 40 units, we have another 40 families who have moved into that gap. So the need is there, and for small CDCs like us, being able to tap the financing that comes through tax credit program is a tremendous asset.
Questions for these witnesses? Maybe I could just anticipate, or maybe go back to the question Representative Verger asked of both of you could address. Who do you contract with typically? That's one of the questions. You know, where these jobs are on the job creation side. Who do you contract with on your projects?
We contract with local builders in our area, in the community. We go through mostly through a competitive bid process, but we get a lot of local builders, local, you know, electricians, plumbers, and so forth. So this really does help our local economy, strengthen our community.
Did you want to add anything?
Just we joke with our general contractor that he has to find all Tigard-based subs because we're a community-based group, and we don't really go that far. But I would say I can't think of any subcontractors or contractors or other development partners, whether it be lenders, architects, anyone we use in the project that isn't from Oregon.
Question.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for about Dallas. Do you have a high or low vacancy rate in the private sector in Dallas?
I'm not exactly sure what the vacancy rate is. We do have some vacancies. I wouldn't say that it is extremely high. We have a very low vacancy rate for the affordable housing units. What we've seen in our neighborhoods is that when we go into a neighborhood and develop even a unit for home ownership or a few units for rental, and we usually don't do very large projects, all of a sudden you find that the surrounding investors, property owners for rentals and homes start upgrading their homes. And I think healthy competition is a very good thing.
Follow up?
Yes, sure.
What I found in and North Bend, that whole area,
right,
is that the housing authority will have a long list, waiting list, but the private sector has a high vacancy rate, which is part of the problem here. You have people that can't move into the private sector apartments, so they're on the waiting list. So it is a little bit of a complex problem in knowing when to say yes, as far as the local community is concerned, to more affordable housing, because you're looking at the list, the long list, of people who need it. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you're hearing from a very strong vocal group of people who don't want that to happen. So,
if I might, Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, there is also a component. And it isn't a part of this particular product or program, but with this product alone, no one could develop housing. As part of some of the other products that the state operates on behalf of the federal government, there are extensive market surveys that have to be done. So in the competition, you have to also demonstrate that there is a market need for that kind of housing and for housing at the proposed rent rates. And so I think one of the reasons that Jack had mentioned that they probably hadn't done that the department had not funded very many projects in the Coos Bay area is probably because they're not scoring well on that based on that situation. But there's part of that is both what are the competitors' rents and how quickly will the units fill. We call it the absorption rate. How fast will the units fill up? And if you don't score well on those kind of market study indicators, you probably won't get funded. And so I think they do take into account as much as they can what's going on in the market from a technical standpoint. We've talked about the community involvement, and all of our organizations are community-based organizations with local boards, local staffs. But then I think the other thing is we go beyond that local community involvement and community-centered piece of what we do to also look technically. We analyze the situation for the housing. So it doesn't help a market that's already overbuilt and has a high vacancy rate, but I think it will at least reduce the chances that a project might get funded in that area.
Yes.
Well, let me respond. I don't think the reason that they haven't built in Coos Bay is totally because they don't qualify. We have a high senior population. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of needy people, so mm-hmm. we qualify quite big. One of the family units that we built actually was built on property that was donated by the city, which is a cooperation mm-hmm. between local government and housing, which I think is very successful. I'm not talking about or against housing mm-hmm. or affordable housing. My problem is the cookie-cutter approach in Oregon and the one-size-fits-all. I think there needs to be things that trigger affordable housing, and I think that sometimes when you have the private sector that has a high vacancy rate, that can be government subsidy in that area, but that continues to help people as well. So I think it's a government private sector balance here that sometimes I worry about. I also don't I'm not at all enthusiastic about creating jobs for people other than Oregonians, because we are in a very, very bad situation. And I have to tell you that every day that I come to revenue, I hear more people wanting tax credits. So here we are, hungry, and everybody wants a break. So please forgive me if I sound a little bit harsh, but I think that we need to be really balancing some of these things. If you have apartment units that can be used as affordable housing, rather than going in and trying to develop more and more, we should try to work in concert with those. So.
Other questions or comments?
Thank you. I have a couple questions. I didn't understand the how the tax credit for the pre-development, how that will enhance the projects that you may have in the future.
Yeah.
And I think that that's more at the, in particular, at your two cases in Tigard and in Dallas.
Somebody, well, yeah, let's talk about the pre-development.
Yeah, if I might just step in and talk a little bit about pre-development. The major pre-development funding source in the state has been the Housing Trust Fund since 1991 when it was established. The amount of money going into the Housing Trust Fund annually has not changed since 1991. But in that amount of time, the costs of construction and pre-development expenses have gone up. So the amount of pre-development activity that we can fund out of the Housing Trust Fund has declined. And so what our groups end up doing is they take out bigger pre-development loans and they hold them for a longer period of time. And what this tax credit would allow us to do would be to take those loans out at a lower interest rate, and it would cost us less to do that. And that's really the point of the tax credit for pre-development is that over the last 12 years, the amount of money available for pre-development hasn't changed. And I don't, you know, given the realistic situation in the budget, we can't expect more grant dollars to come out of the state. So we were looking for a way to leverage state dollars. This program leverages at about 25-1 in terms of the amount of dollars that it leverages. So we thought this is why we wanted to use this approach to deal with the fact that we have increased costs, but where there's not going to be increased state funding to cover those costs.
Follow up?
Yes, sure.
So then how do we determine that that's a reduction in rents to the qualified?
That was an issue that the department has worked on a lot, and because it was so hard to figure out how to trace that amount through a pre-development lending piece into the final project, that was the reason that they said that this is the reason it's a little bit different animal than the rest of the credit. They said, since it's so hard to track and figure out how, you know, to track that dollar through as a reduced rent, the proposal is that it would not require showing that pass-through dollar. It would probably end up being fairly small when you think about a pre-development loan and the interest rate only over a couple of years, or at most. It would be a very small amount. And so that was the reason the department wanted to limit it just to the $200,000 to make sure that we don't do anything to the effectiveness of the rest of this program that does pass through every dollar in the form of reduced rents.
Okay.
I could respond to that as well. I think with pre-development...
I'm going to bring the microphone over a little bit closer there to you. Thanks.
With pre-development loans, the big issue for us is always the timing. And as John mentioned, the trust fund has been one of the few sources where we could get up to maybe $100,000 per project in sort of after the fact. So there have been a couple of sources, Enterprise Foundation, private folks who have tried to come into the state and provide pre-development money. The state sometimes... It's kind of a cyclical issue if there's pre-development money out there at 5.5% to 6% and how much you can get. When we need it early in the project, we end up investing $40,000 of our own money. We're a tiny nonprofit that lives, you know, we have six staff and spend about $2,000 a month other than payroll costs. I mean, we don't have a huge margin to upfront that money to make these projects happen. So having the money available and not waiting for a state round where we may or may not get trust fund money, which is a small portion of what we need to prime the pump to get the projects going, both the pre-development planning expenses as well as acquiring the land prior to getting all the funding together for the project. So in our perspective, that's why we're always looking to support any way to get more capacity for pre-development financing.
All right. Further?
Further, please. Yeah. Who ends up owning it after the project is started?
Well, the 0.01% general partner is us, and we're the ones that really manage the project from day to day. I mean, the big money, the equity through the tax credit program comes in from private investors, KeyBank, in our case, but lots of different private investors who take advantage of these tax credits. But really, the owner is the local general partner who manages it or works with a property manager to manage it from day to day who puts the money in when things aren't going well.
The local owner received the pre-development incentives also?
Well, I guess when John was trying to describe how does the pre-development financing affect the whole project, say the last project we did, which was about a $3.6 million, maybe $200,000, $300,000 is attributable to acquiring the land and doing some of the early pre-development work. It's not a huge part of the project. The question is you need it when you need it or the project doesn't happen. So... that does all the costs related to the project go into calculating what rents you can then charge. And in our case, unlike the private sector, we're trying to get them as low as possible. And so every dollar that we save has an impact on what ultimate rents can be in the end.
Mm-hmm. All right. One more.
Yes.
SDCs, are they included in the pre-development?
You know, in Washington County, which is a real difficult to develop area, they are, and they're very high. Some jurisdictions like Tigard have adopted SDC or fee waivers in part to try to make an impact on that. In Portland, certainly they have active program in that area. Around the state, typically those are one of the highest costs in new construction.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you very much, all of you. We have Bill Van Vliet. And while Mr. Van Vliet is getting seated, I see we also have written testimony from the Revenue Coalition. Is this just a leaflet drop? Okay, so we're not going to have... Okay. This is funny. Mr. Van Vliet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bill Van Vliet, and I am the Executive Director for Network for Urban Affordable Housing. For those of you that aren't familiar with NOAA, we're a nonprofit multi-bank lending consortium that provides permanent financing for affordable housing projects all around the state. We are one of Oregon's primary permanent sources of financing for affordable housing projects, and currently over about 90% of our projects benefit from the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit Program. We were formed in 1990 under the leadership of the Oregon Bankers Association. We have more than 20 Oregon banks that participate and fund in our program. I've handed out, I believe it's being handed out now, some written testimony and a couple of examples. And then also included in that on the final page, just for reference, is a page of some photos of just some of our developments. I think it's helpful to put a visual picture out of what it is that's being developed as affordable housing these days. These are very attractive projects. There's a lot of thought that goes into making them fit into the communities. And they're very, very significant community revitalization tools, whether it's new construction or renovation of existing projects. These projects create jobs both during the construction phases, as has been talked about already, and then also during the day-to-day operations. There's a significant amount of job creation with operating these on an ongoing basis for the life of the project. So these definitely create job opportunities throughout the state. NOAA clearly supports House Bill 2171, both aspects of increasing the cap and then also allowing a small allocation of the cap for pre-development lending. With regards to increasing the cap, many Oregon renters continue to face really daunting gaps between what they can afford to pay for rent and what market rents are out there in the communities. And therefore, these households are rent burdened and they pay extraordinary portions of their income for housing alone, leaving very little left for things such as food and clothing. And I'm sure you've heard plenty about all of that. The Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit is one of the most successful and valuable state programs that addresses housing affordability in particular. And it's also one of the few significant tools the state has to create housing to reach those lower income households as opposed to the ones closer to the median income. I guess just to emphasize a couple of key points, and I won't go over all of my testimony because a lot of it has been very well stated by the previous speakers, but again, to emphasize, it's an extremely efficient program. The credit is delivered through lenders, but it's solely for the benefit of the tenants. There's no profit to the banks in this particular credit program, and I just want to emphasize that. It all goes to the tenants. It's relatively simple for the banks to administer as well, and so I think that that's one of the reasons the banks have been happy to continue to support this credit in their communities. Their credits are not discounted and sold as other tax credits can be, so 100% of these credits flow through to the tenants and actually benefit state policy, which is a little bit unusual compared to some other tax credit programs that exist. And then finally, the credit leverages private capital to achieve even greater affordability. I've attached a couple of exhibits just for a quick example. And Exhibit 1 shows the same development, just a real quick summary. The development if it did not have the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, and then the development if it did. And what you can see is we can achieve greater affordability reaching a household that may be at 60% of median income with the credit. You can reach a household that's at 50% of median income. And then I've demonstrated what that is as far as household income for the year. The other part of Exhibit 1 that I think is useful to show is if the state wanted to achieve the same level of affordability without that Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit program, it would require a significant capital contribution that would have to come from somewhere, and really that means grants. And so for the same project, the project at 60% of median income could support a loan, at 50% with the OAHTC could support a loan of $960,000. That same project serving the same population at 50% without the OAHTC would be able to only support a loan of $620,000. So essentially this program through the tax credit saves what would amount to a $340,000 one-time capital contribution that would have to come from somewhere, whether it's public or private grant resources. So it's a very powerful program in achieving affordability. With regards to pre-development lending, which we're a strong supporter of expanding the program, there is a shortage of readily available pre-development financing. And a lot of it is because the cost of that capital is high enough that would render projects infeasible even if it were available. There are very few sources that are available. They tend to be oversubscribed and fully lent out. By making this credit available, I believe that additional private sector capital would flow, increasing the availability of pre-development lending. And again, the benefits, in summary, for adding pre-development lending is it would bring more private sector capital into that realm of lending, and NOAA will be looking at ways to do that itself. A short-term, small tax credit would leverage up to $5 million of private sector capital that would become available for pre-development lending. And if you look at, pre-development loans and the $100,000 to $200,000 range rolling on a 1 to 2 year basis, that's quite a few projects that can benefit from this program. The lower costs of pre-development lending will lower the overall project costs. And these projects are already burdened with very, very tight budgets, and every dollar saved is a very big benefit and can sometimes make the difference between feasibility and infeasibility with these projects. And it also lowers the gap of other public resources that are needed up front into the form of grants to help get these projects off the ground. So in short, the availability of affordable pre-development funding can mean the difference between proceeding and not proceeding with the project. And again, the projects that tend to serve the lowest income populations are those developed by the nonprofit community around the state. And the nonprofits, as was stated earlier, tend to not have deep cash resources for pre-development and seed capital into these projects. Being able to obtain this kind of financing that's at an affordable interest rate would greatly benefit their ability to proceed with their development activities. And I did point out just a brief example on Exhibit 2 for the pre-development lending activities. If you had even a $500,000 loan, I just gave some ballpark numbers of where it might be, but you could save between $30,000 and $40,000 of upfront capital for a project. And those are other sources of grants that therefore don't have to be raised and closes the gap on feasibility of a project. The Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit has been an extremely powerful tool to achieve affordability beyond what other programs can provide, and is one of the few tools available to help provide affordable homes to low-income Oregonians. The program is efficient. It solely benefits low-income Oregonians, and it maximizes the public policy benefit while leveraging private capital to make housing more affordable. I do want to point out a couple of things that are not in my remarks. And there's been a number of questions about economic development and job creation. On the construction side, again, most of the projects that we finance are being constructed by Oregon-based contractors. There's a number of people that get involved with these projects from the development phase, whether they're surveyors or appraisers, plumbers, general contractors, landscapers. Almost in every case, those are Oregon-based companies and Oregon-based jobs that are feeding into local economies. Just by way of example, I think to give you an idea of some of the leverage that comes out of not only the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, but all of affordable housing. NOAA has financed about $77 million in loans to date across the state in our 10 years. The total project cost for those projects is nearly $300 million. And that's $300 million going into local communities and local economies in the form of jobs to develop these projects. And then again, there's the ongoing operations where there's several people involved in the ongoing operation and management of these developments. In response to the question about competing with private sector properties, again, I believe that there's a couple of factors here, and one, again, is the rent burdens. There are some of the higher vacancies because the people that need this housing simply can't afford and therefore are not living in the private sector projects that are out there. So there may be ways to pull the private sector owners currently that are not participating into these programs, which would be very helpful for affordable housing and for lower-income Oregonians by utilizing some of the state programs that are out there. We have financed a number of acquisition rehab projects from existing projects. They've been renovated, upgraded significantly, and then made affordable in the communities. And then also I think there's a couple of just from the private sector lending standpoint, a couple of things. We will only finance projects that have a significant rent discount off of what the market will provide. And so there's not going to be very direct competition, at least at the rent levels. It's going to only be available if private money will flow to support affordable housing only if there's a distinctive rent differential that's demonstrated. The other thing that we look for very carefully is what we call a capture rate. When we go in to finance and analyze the feasibility of a project, we look for how many potential income-qualified renters there are in that community. and then how many of those our project is intending to capture. One of the rules of thumb is that we look for a 10% capture rate to give us plenty of buffer on demand for a project. So by no means are we going out and developing a project that's going to capture every potential available renter that's in a community. So we're really not necessarily taking all of the potential renters in a community for these affordable housing projects. And with that, I would urge your support of this piece of legislation. It's been very, very successful, and it's a very important piece of legislation to achieve affordability for low-income Oregonians.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Vansley, thank you.
Yep.
Questions from the committee? Senator Williams, you're looking for yourself in that picture of the...
I don't believe I'm in this picture.
We did a good cropping job.
I couldn't find you on the slide either.
They airbrushed me. I was there that day, though.
All right, thanks so much for your testimony.
Director Repine, Bob Repine with us here today.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. I was in my office watching on television, and some of this conversation, I decided to kind of jet over here and spend a couple moments with you, if I could, to clarify. It has to do with what Mr. Van Vliet was talking about in the marketplace. And I, Representative Varger and I have had this discussion. Matter of fact, we had a trip to Vancouver one time during the interim that we talked a little about housing and the issues of how it affects communities differently. And in her area, Coos Bay is a good example, and I want to show you how that really can work, both to the advantage of the state and to the community. We understand, we truly believe that there probably is a market penetration that in Coos Bay there's a high amount of vacancies in that area. So market is available. And the representative did mention the fact that the housing authorities do have people with vouchers that are eligible for this housing. Well, the anomaly comes in as two ways. And first of all, let me explain to you, the vouchers come in two forms. One are site-based vouchers that belong to the development, so they people move into those with the subsidy being part of the apartment, if it's Section 8. Or they're sticky vouchers, and those are, for lack of a better way of describing them, are ones that travel with the people. And if somebody has or is eligible to have a sticky voucher and they're moving around in the community, the key is to try to find somebody who's willing to accept it and who's willing to submit themselves or their project to being subsidized housing or federally approved housing for that use of that voucher. So that's where some of the anomalies happen with many communities. We have not unlike Coos Bay, there are areas up in Clackamas County where there's a huge amount of vouchers that are out amongst the people, but if the private sector does not pick them up or acknowledge them as a form of rebate or a cost substitute from real cash and participate via with the housing authority to be on an approved list and make sure your housing meets certain characteristics and standards, then the vouchers aren't used. They can't be used because if there's no provider out there that will take them, then they go back without being utilized. What we've tried to do in the state, and we've tried to set this up as a partnership with the private sector, is work on a program that comes by a variety of different names, but it either is be called Ready to Rent, which is in the Portland area. In the Eugene area, it's called Fresh Second Chance, and in the Salem, Marin County area, it's called Fresh Start. And what happens there is where people who are either have vouchers or people who are more than likely will find it difficult to find marketable or apartments that are available to them on the open market because either they have bad credit, they have not the right income ratio to the cost of the apartment, in other words, they're paying more than they technically should be paying, a variety of things that become the automatic barriers for people who are trying to find housing in the open market environment. And quite frankly, we recognize that landlords have every right to be both concerned and suspicious as to whether or not opening up their doors, letting somebody in who might have some characteristics that are flawed by the perception of both being having bad credit or being evicted before, that they might be setting themselves up to potential risks within their apartment. So we have to appreciate that. We have, and we try to identify that. And so what we've done with our state resources within our agency, we set aside an account that allows people who go through these various training programs that are around the state, pretty much almost all statewide, but probably not everywhere, that once they go through a training program of this learning how to be a good renter, it seems somewhat silly maybe for you to be sitting there and hearing me say how to be a good renter, but quite frankly, there are generations of people who have never had the opportunity that many of us had from our parents or other peers to learn what does it mean to be a good steward of property. We don't necessarily know that because we've never ever had maybe that opportunity to talk to us. So these classes are very basic in the sense they teach people how to do basic management, how to do life skills within an apartment, to make sure your freezer doesn't turn green over 6 months, you know, try to clean it out, things that general public just takes second nature. And so these people have graduated, and people graduate through this program. Now the key is once they've graduated through it, what do you do with the person? To have the graduation certificate in your hand is wonderful, but if still if there's nobody from the private sector who's willing to take these people on as a potential risk client, then you haven't gotten nowhere with them. So what we have done is put together a program where we will underwrite or guarantee up to $1,000 of damage or unpaid bills by a resident who graduates from these programs. In other words, we have said, if you are willing to take the time to learn to be a good resident, we, the state, or my agency, will afford to the private sector apartment owner a guarantee that will not exceed $1,000 or up to 2 months of your rent, so that and it's designed to be like a 6 month probation period. And after 6 months, if that person or that family has proved to be good residents, then that guarantee is taken away and it's moved to another family. But the idea is that we want to create an opportunity for that landlord to be willing to take the risk with somebody who, quite frankly, brings a potential risk with them. And we're saying we believe that they will cooperate and act well. And so because of that, we feel strong enough, we'll put resources up. Now, there is a certain risk with that, obviously. But we've just been doing this for like the last 2 years, and primarily in the metropolitan Portland area is our largest group. And of the 100, and I'm going to pull these off the top of my head and I give you more factual numbers, but in excess of 170 families who have graduated, 500 people have taken the classes of the 170 who have graduated, and the resources that we've put out behind those families to put the rich money up behind them, we've only had claims as reported this year of $5,000. That tells me a couple of things, that we had some people that slipped between the cracks, and you can expect that. But at the same time, we've had a whole lot of people be very successful with this, and these are people who are being placed in market-rate, non-subsidized apartments. The people like Representative Barrier has within her community. So the idea is if the landlords have vacancies, and I think one of the earlier people who testified made a comment, if they have vacancies, we have a program designed to help facilitate both training and back resources that will give them some certainty that the person will act and conduct themselves in a proper fashion. I've told many people in my agency, always in my agency, but many of you as your colleagues, that the Oregon cannot build their way out of this process. We cannot. We don't have enough money to build enough apartments to build us out of the affordable issues. And so we have to strongly rely on the current marketplace. And so this tool that we've developed, even a small tool as it is, does allow a certain percentage of people who are having difficulty finding placement, it just becomes that one carrot that the landlord says, okay, if I know that I've got a $1,000 risk back guarantee on this person, I'll take the chance. And so we've been working with apartment owners associations around the state. I think we have this program probably running up and running about 4 or 5 different areas. We hope that it will expand because we think it's a wonderful tool. It lets the existing property and property managers enjoy the benefits of having tenants, and also with some guarantees that there's less likelihood that there's going to be some damages to their property. So that is one approach. The other piece that you heard about, Mr. Van Vliet, talking about renovation, rehabilitation in every community. When you see property that goes on the block for sale that has been, in many cases, poorly maintained or has become dilapidated over a period of time, when our partners will pick these up, they will turn these around and make them very nicely reconverted, complementary pieces to the community. And subsequent to that, then you see, as one of the earlier witnesses testified on, you'll see other people in the community starting to become reinvested in their community. They'll start paying their houses. They'll start picking up their lawns. So it becomes kind of a cyclical process because we can come in there. So it isn't always new. Just as I told, I think Representative Verger, if you can remember, when we were traveling back to Washington, it cost us twice as much in just about every general community to build new construction. So in other words, if in Portland it cost us $120,000 a unit, if we were doing renovation rehabilitation, we could do it for $60,000. If in Representative Verger's area, if new construction was costing us, because the market's a little less, let's say $90,000 per unit, we could probably assume that the renovation rehabilitation, and I mean rehabilitating so they don't look like what they were when they were bought, will cost $45,000 to $50,000 per unit. So true advantage for the state of Oregon to use those resources to recapture resources that are being underutilized and will improve the community is what these Oregon Lenders Tax Credits develop. And then as the complementary piece is to try to address the issue of current landlords who want to rent but don't want the risk of renting. What can we do to minimize that? And that's why we put this renter relief program in place.
Okay. So that kind of fills us in on some of the other pieces that we don't see in this.
Right.
Yeah.
But and that's why I wanted to bring it up, because
sure.
The comments were made.
Representative Verger?
I think I've known this at one time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, but I've forgotten it. Do you have residency requirements and working history and also what's the highest income that I can make and still qualify?
Well, I would say, to try to answer that, Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, income eligibility is based on the units. They can be everywhere from 50% medium income and below, 60, 40. So the units are defined or designed to have certain restrictions of income to them. So you kind of have to place the person into the unit mix.
Okay.
But it is dealing with, you know, people who are lower income, national poverty level people, and I probably suspect it's 80% in total. 60 to 80% of median income.
In one of the suburbs.
Well, again, each county is different. Income levels, county by county, are set by HUD, and they vary from county by county.
Okay.
We can give you a map. Actually, give you a chart. They just were published in the last month. We can give you a chart to show you how much they have changed in the state and what they were last year. You can get an idea what those income rates are.
Okay, and residency requirements?
For the most part, there are residency requirements. I'm pretty sure.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
He said it varies from program to program. So I guess I would have to yield to somebody in the audience who have a better feel for that discussion. But there is programs that do have residency requirements. Some of them do not.
Are those federal requirements? These are federal programs.
I suspect they would be,
yes.
And working history was the other one.
I think working history really comes under the kind of the application process. The people who become residents here have to go through an application process to show some level of competency, both to either pay whatever rent they're going to pay or show some form of income that will offset or augment the balance of the rent. I mean, if you think of it in the case of a family, somebody who might be living with disabilities, they have SSI, so their income is their check that they get monthly from the federal government, of which a percentage of it would go to their housing. So it may not be income in the sense of having a job, but it could be a check that comes in for a subsidy for somebody. But generally you will find in most of our affordable housing projects, the family units, not people necessarily obviously with disabilities, but in our family units, family ones that you heard about from Washington County, you will generally find a high percentage, if not 100%, of those are working Oregonians. Rarely do you find people that are, you know, just slacking it and are on welfare or something like that. They are people who have jobs and to support their families, and they just need the extra reduction in the rent to make it fit within their budgetary constraints that they're faced with.
All right, very good. Any further questions or comments? Thanks for coming over.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate that. Anybody else wish to testify on this today before I close the public hearings on both bills? I want to thank everyone for a good overview and discussion of this. We'll have these back. And if there are no further comments or questions from the committee, I'll close the public hearings on House Bills 2168 and 2171. And with that, we are adjourned.